guitar music. They played it in that old hillbilly way. Dan Foley came from Kentucky. Down and out of Texas, don't see. And we'll remember they made the first atomic bomb in Tennessee. Tennessee credit for music. They played up in Nashville every day. Tennessee credit for music. They played in that old hillbilly way.
When we first were invited down here by Jude, we wanted to... There's any number of things that we'd like to talk about on the show, topic-wise, focus in on. And one that really seemed to suggest itself was the Beatles' Southern roots, because it is so rich. It's unbelievable. The Beatles recorded, what, 213 songs in their canon, the body of work, not counting the live stuff or BBC or some of the obscurity stuff, just the straightforward studio albums. 213 tracks, and of them... There are 24 covers they recorded, songs written by other people. And of those 24 covers, 14 are by Southern artists. It really showed where their heart was and their influences, not only in choices of material, but in songwriting influence, performing influence, instrumentation. You know, George Harrison picking up the Chet Atkins Country Gentleman guitar. John Lennon's use of a blues harp on Love Me Do, direct Southern influence. So the impact Southern artists had on the Beatles' art is immeasurable.
Yeah, and you can hear, I mean, well, Ringo, for a start off, was a really huge country and Western fan.
Yeah.
Right through, you know, through the 1950s into the 60s.
And into the 70s when he did his second solo album down in Nashville.
Yeah.
Bukus of Blues, as he pronounced it.
Yes.
Well, the rest of the world calls it Buku.
Bukus of Blues.
Yeah. A great album produced by a bunch of Nashville star artists, musicians, and producers, recorded in a week, and still one of his best regarded solo albums. I mean, it was a great, great fit for his skill set. You know, he had such an innate feel for country music, and it really shines on that album.
Yeah, and then you got George Harrison, who was a huge Chet Atkins fan, and of course, Chet Atkins in 1964 did his own covers of Beatles.
Chet Atkins picks on the Beatles.
On the Beatles, absolutely.
Yeah. A great classic of the genre.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was not one of these people that... there were a lot of people that were establishment artists that kind of looked down on the Beatles as just a teeny bop, bubblegum act. The right people got it. You know, everybody from Bob Dylan to a Chet Atkins who could appreciate the craftsmanship and the artistry and what they were doing. So, you know, he naturally gravitated toward their material. Hey, this is really worthwhile stuff. And maybe if I record an album of it, I can interest my fan base in what the Beatles are doing.
Yeah, if you listen to the Beatles For Sale album.
1964.
Yeah, and it's absolutely full of George Harrison's Chet Atkins influence. Guitar work.
Right, he's playing that big country gentleman guitar that met an untimely death on the road.
Absolutely.
Literally, when it fell off the back of their car and got run over. So that's one of the few that you don't see in part of the George Harrison collection anymore. But I was doing some background research on the artists and where they hailed from that the Beatles covered. Now, when they were first getting their rock and roll aspirations going, after starting out as a skiffle group, you know, skiffle, Lonnie Donegan was covering a lot of Appalachian American cover tunes, folk tunes, folk and blues tunes. Jug band music. And, you know, stuff like Lead Belly, who I believe is from Texas originally.
Yes.
And, you know, Rock Island Line, stuff like that, that was sort of traditional rural music. But the Beatles pivoted from that once Rock Around the Clock hit, and that introduced them to the world of rock and roll in 1955. I had always been kind of under the impression that Bill Haley was of the South, because prior to Rock Around the Clock, he was his group was not Bill Haley and the Comets, it was Bill Haley and the Saddlemen, and they were a Western swing outfit.
Yeah.
And if you ever hear some of their stuff, I mean, it's quite good, and he plays it like he was born into it. He's actually from Pennsylvania.
Right.
he died in Texas.
Yes.
So we won't include him on the list. But
does everyone here know what skiffle is, skiffle music? Are you familiar with that?
The Quarrymen being the first group that John Lennon formed as a 16-year-old with a bunch of non-musicians that were part of his schoolmates, it required very little musical talent. It was basic three-chord stuff. You would keep percussion on scraping thimbles on your fingers on a washboard.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'd be like a washtub bass.
What they called a tea chest bass, actually.
In England, they did.
Yeah. It was a tea chest, a sort of wooden box, and they'd drill a hole in it, put a broom handle, and then attach a piece of string from the top of the broom handle to the bottom. And
pluck it, and you can adjust the pitch by, you know, moving the broomstick around. So,
and really what this was, it was music for the masses. It was what all the kids could afford. And, you know, Britain in the 1950s, post-war, was really, the kids were cash-strapped. It wasn't like, you know, America was a golden era.
Yeah, very affluent.
Britain won the war but lost it economically. It was broke. So for these kids, John Lennon and his mates, this was the way to make music at the beginning, get a beaten-up old guitar. What was it in the advert? Guaranteed not to split.
Yeah. Like a 9-pound guitar.
And so that's how, you know, they would make. And it was 1956 into 57. Skiffle was a massive craze in Britain. And
virtually everyone who became a 60s guitarist in the British invasion, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, they were all, the gateway for them into musicality was skiffle music. But once rock and roll hit right on its heels, you know, first there was Bill Haley kicking the door open at Rock Around the Clock. You know, that story John Lennon told about going to see the movie Blackboard Jungle.
Yeah.
And he'd read the press reports, because he was reading newspapers at a young age, of how riots were breaking out wherever this movie was playing. And so he went to the theater all intent on tearing up the seats and being disappointed nobody else was doing it. But it did get him into rock and roll, but
it was Heartbreak Hotel that changed everything.
That changed everything, because not only was this rock and roll, but it was actually somebody incredibly charismatic, Elvis Presley, in a way that Bill Haley wasn't.
Right.
And that was what really inspired them to segue from skiffle into rock and roll, which met a lot of resistance from the people that were bandmates at the time, because it was something that there weren't many rock venues to play at in Britain, because it was considered this thing associated with gangs and rumbles and just riots. You didn't want to invite that into your club for fear a brawl would break out.
Right. So, you know, rock and roll kicks in sort of in 1957, really it takes off in Britain in a big way, and skiffle is kind of dead. And now they've got a whole new roster of influences, basically, and a lot of them from the South.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I was researching this, breaking it down, you've got artists from Louisiana, Larry Williams, who had been a sort of protege of Little Richard and followed him on the Specialty label. They covered three of his songs as part of the Beatles catalog, Slow Down, Dizzy Miss Lizzie, and Bad Boy. You know, this was primal rock and roll stuff. And in their club acts, they were doing Lottie Miss Claudie, which was also one of his tunes, as did Elvis. You also had from Louisiana, of course, Jerry Lee Lewis, Sun Records being another, like, stable of artists that they just, you know, sucked up all that stuff as the records were coming out. And then you had Bobby Parker from Lafayette, yeah, who, not a well-known name now, but he was a guitarist who played with Bo Diddley. And he recorded a song around 1961 called Watch Your Step that was sort of this Latin beat thing influenced by Ray Charles, What I'd Say.
But just John, like some other guy.
Right, but John Lennon lifted it practically wholesale for I Feel Fine. That was sort of their take on Bobby Parker's Watch Your Step. So another guy of the South, and of course Fats Domino, you know, who they're playing his material in their club days, didn't record any of his compositions at EMI, but the turnabout was in 68 when they were moving away from the psychedelia and going into this sort of rootsy back to basics approach. The first single they cut that year, Lady Madonna, is Fats Domino incarnate. And to sort of really put the cherry on the cake of that release, who records their own version of it but Fats Domino, and does a great version of it. Yeah, so you've got that. You've got from Texas, of course, you know, Buddy Holly. You know, Elvis was the one that really got them inspired by rock, but Buddy Holly was more a direct roadmap on what to do. First of all, he had glasses, which was great for John, who was very averse to wearing his glasses in public, but then he got Buddy Holly frames, and it was cool. Buddy wrote his own material. He sort of prototyped the four-man lineup, lead guitar, rhythm guitar, drums, and bass. And he did a lot of his own arranging and, you know, calling the shots. He wasn't the tool of some producer.
And again, he was. He was someone who was just like the guy next door, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
He's like, we can achieve this. We can put a band together like that.
Yes.
A five-piece band.
Right. And that was huge. And poor Buddy, his career ended when he was 22 years old, when you think about what might have been. But it's interesting. Mark Lewison talks about this in Tune In, and it's been chronicled before, that Buddy Holly actually played Liverpool in 1958.
Yeah, the Empire Theatre.
Yeah, and the Beatles, this is their hero. And yet they didn't go to see him.
Well, what they did was they watched him on television in 1957. I think he was on Sunday night at the London Palladium.
Yes.
Which was a variety show, a bit like the Ed Sullivan show in Britain.
Right.
And they all tuned in to see. That was the first time they saw a solid-bodied guitar, the Fender Strat.
Yeah. And it was, I've read the quote from Eric Clapton, who, you know, another rock and roll fan in that world, you know, sort of a peer at that time, who, when he saw that performance, and they're doing Peggy Sue, and he was just blown away by the fact that the fretting movement is minimal to play that song, and yet you get this great sound. It's like, wow, it's that easy. And he was off and running. It's just amazing, and you know, the Strat being his, you know, best-known instrument tied to Clapton. So
what music are we going to play?
Well, let's give an example. You know, one of the things that the Beatles were very poorly regarded by their peers in Liverpool. They were a group that had a very hard time holding on to a drummer once they sort of dropped off all the non-musicians that were the Quarrymen and started getting serious. February 1958, they bring George Harrison in on lead guitar. You know, he is this greatly talented, you know, with this obsession for learning his parts till his fingers bled. You know, at the same time, he was much younger than them, you know, much younger than John, so it made it kind of, you know, should we bring him in or not? He's just a bloody kid, as John would say, but his talent could not be denied. So they bring him in, so now they're really getting serious. But holding on to, you know, getting a bass player in was something that took some time before they really had solidified that role, and a drummer was even harder to come by. Nonetheless, while they're being disrespected by their peers as a group that are just a bunch of wannabes, the sound that set them apart was the fact that John and Paul and George's voices blended so well together. That was a very unique mix among the Liverpool groups at the time, who typically had one lead singer and then some guys behind him doing maybe call and response or sort of backing things. The Beatles had these super tight harmonies, and that was straight out of the Everly Brothers, who, you know, again, you associate them with the South. You know, Kentucky is where Don, the older brother, was born. Phil was born in Chicago.
Yes, I know.
And then they grew up in Iowa before they moved back to Kentucky when they were in their teens.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, they were steeped in that tradition of tight harmony singing, like the Leuven brothers before them.
Yeah, well, Paul McCartney, I think the first time he actually got up on a stage was with his younger brother, Mike.
Yes.
And they did, I think, Bye Bye Love.
Right.
Everly Brothers.
Yeah, a big hit record, 57.
Yeah.
So let's play, during their recording dates with the BBC through 1963, they were very cover heavy in playing the stuff that had been part of their club sets. So we're lucky to have the recordings of this stuff. Here's them doing an Everly Brothers song called Don't Ever Change, and it gives a great illustration of how tight their harmonies were.
You never wear a stitch of lace, your powder's never on your face, you're always wearing jeans, except on Sunday. So please don't ever change. No, don't you ever change. I kinda like you just the way you are.
And what's particularly unique about that performance is you associate John and Paul as the lead tight harmony singers. That's Paul and George.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And during the...
Well, George's role as a vocalist got diminished once they made it.
Once they were recording almost exclusively original material. But back when they were recovering anybody's material, you know, the everything was wide open and fair game. And he sang a heck of a lot of lead vocals.
Really, he had a third of the lead vocals.
Yes. And it's interesting, when they did acquire a drummer and a bass player, such as it was, for the first tour they did in May of 1960, Scotland, where they were as a backing band with a singer named Johnny Gentle. Not much of a singer. He's kind of this contrived act that Larry Parnes was producing with all those names like Johnny Gentle, Vince Eager, Billy Fury, Dickie Pride.
Marty Wilde.
Yes, all these great rock star names,
and
such
the
as it were.
They had all these, as Paul said, all these furious names, and they got Johnny Gentle.
Yeah, they got Johnny Gentle out of all the possible picks. Nonetheless, the Beatles themselves, except for John, changed their own names to have stage names for this tour. And, you know, Paul was Paul Ramone. Where he got that from?
Just an exotic French-sounding name.
Yes, but George adopted his name Carl Harrison.
And that was for Carl Perkins.
Of course, from Tennessee. And he was a huge influence on them, not only as songwriters and guitarists, but just the material that was making up their club act. And again, George was singing a lot more leads during those days before they were recording more Lennon McCartney stuff. So let's hear Glad All Over, because it's a great rocking performance by him on a Carl Perkins song.
Ain't no doubt about it, this must be love. A one little kiss from you and I feel glad all over. Ooh, baby, heart, don't get me silly, but I'm glad all over. Get a goose pimples, baby, cause I feel so good when you cuddle me like you do, and I feel glad all over. Ooh, mercy, I'm a rock, don't pop me, and I'm happy, and I'm glad all over.
Quite a lot of personality in there.
He's killing it.
Yeah.
I mean, where do you hear George rocking that hard? Maybe Roll Over Beethoven, but man, that was so close to his heart. He was loving it. He was just, you know, really feeling that stuff.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's why when they did the BBC sessions in 1963, started off in 62 and went through 64, but the bulk of them were done in 63 for BBC Radio. And they got to do a lot of the songs that they, you know, couldn't fit onto albums in the studio. And also they were now writing their own material. But they still love, you know, these old country numbers. So that's where they recorded them.
Yeah. You know what? I need to correct something that I said. We played Don't Ever
Not
Change.
For the first time, I might.
This is what editing is for, Richard. It's to make you look good.
Thank you.
But in this instance, I'm going to self-correct in real time. For your listening pleasure, we played Don't Ever Change. That was actually the Crickets, not the Everly Brothers that we were using for the tight harmony illustration. It was the Crickets post Buddy Holly that went on and had a few hits when Sonny Curtis came in. He later on was famous for recording and writing the theme to the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Love Is All Around. But he also wrote the song I Fought the Law, as recorded by Bobby Fuller IV. It was originally recorded by the Crickets. Anyway, the Everly Brothers song that they recorded was So How Come No One Loves Me, another tight harmony song found in the BBC record. So I wanted to make that correction before somebody pointed it out to me.
Also point out that early on, I think it was 1960, the John and Paul were just sort of hiking across England.
Yes.
And they visited the pub of one of Paul's cousins. And very generously, they were told that in return for helping behind the bar in this pub, they could perform. Can you imagine that? You know, they had to work to be able to perform. And they billed themselves as the Nurk Twins. And, you know, they just sat on two stools and sang, and they sang quite a few, apparently, Everly Brothers.
Right, the tight harmony stuff.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. You point that out. The Nurk Twins, that sort of John and Paul dynamic of working as a unit together. We saw a glimmer of that years later, 1969, when John brings in the song, The Ballad of John and Yoko, and he wanted it recorded instantly. He was getting more and more the mindset that, you know, as quickly as I get the inspiration to write a song, it needs to be out in a timely fashion. Right away. And so when he wanted to record, only Paul was available, and George and Ringo, George was out of the country and Ringo was busy elsewhere. So John brought in Paul. Paul played the drums. They did the guitar and the bass and the piano together. It was sort of a return to that Nurk Twins thing. And what's very interesting is the approach that they had with that was reminiscent of some of the songs that they played earlier. Particularly, what would you say, Johnny Burnett, Lonesome Tears in My Eyes?
Absolutely.
Yeah, if you've got that song. Johnny Burnett was out of Memphis. And he also was the guy that recorded Your 16.
Yes.
Yeah, so here's a song that was part of their club act from 1960 or so, is when the original record came out.
Oh, baby, 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 blues are sorrow, and I'll love you tomorrow, just suit you just fine.
Oh, baby, 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 blues or sorrow, I love you tomorrow, just suit you just fine. I can't forget that you told me so many promising lies. I'm trying to forget these lonesome tears in my eyes. You've broken my heart, gonna do it again. I can't forget the spell that I'm in. Can't forget that you told me so many promising lies. I'm trying to forget these lonesome tears in my eyes.
A little bit of Ballad of John and Yoko in there, and the guitar. Yeah, I mean, it's not so much a harmony song, but it definitely, again, as with George, as with Paul, as with John, as with Ringo, the earliest rock and roll they absorbed would stay with them forever. And as late as, you know, their solo years, there are bootleg recordings in the studio of them, you know, warming up and jamming, and they're just running through this back catalog of 50s rock and roll. You know, during, you know, John Lennon's recording in 1970, this emotionally devastating record, Plastic Ono Band, with Mother and I Found Out and Working Class Hero on it, in between takes, he's playing Matchbox and Don't Be Cruel. You know, just in, you know, playing with Ringo and playing with Klaus, this very basic rock and roll that was where their roots were.
I used to love that.
Something else, we haven't spoken much about Paul so far, and one thing that I find kind of amusing is that, you know, a lot of British rock and rollers in the 1950s and the 1960s, because rock and roll was an American phenomenon, they would sing with an American accent, okay? So, you know, you hear them, I can, you know, see
yeah,
you and baby, and all this sort of stuff. And I love the fact that actually John Lennon really mostly sang with an English accent, with a Liverpudlian accent. He doesn't usually resort to the American accent. But listen to Paul on this number. Which,
yeah, from Carl Perkins.
Yeah.
I'm sure to fall in love. I'm sure to fall.
Yeah, so you really hear the affectation in Paul's voice, and I think he saw himself as role-playing. I mean, it was definitely pretty apparent early on that whatever rock and roll he was listening to, he would try to emulate the singer before he really found his own style. We'd played it on an earlier show, but there's a BBC recording of Paul singing That's All Right, Mama, you know, the Arthur Crudup song sung by Elvis as his first son hit, and you really hear the sort of southernisms creeping into Paul's voice, like, who are you kidding? But... You know, Liverpool's in the north, not the south. But another artist I was going to say that really became sort of Paul's parlor trick when he was trying to impress people, even pre-Quarrymen, was his uncanny ability to imitate Little Richard.
Oh, absolutely.
Little Richard being from Macon, Georgia. And another artist who's, you know, one hit after another, the Quarrymen and then the Beatles were absorbing. They were in their club act, and they also ended up on their EMI recordings. Kansas City, Hey, Hey, Hey. And Long Tall Sally being this unbelievable performance by Paul recorded in a single take in 1964 following them coming to America and conquering it and then working on the Hard Day's Night film. So they were working nonstop and yet they had time to duck into a studio to record this EP of rock and roll and, you know, single take.
I'm gonna tell- Summer night, I saw the John with long dark
know, just remarkable for me that their first American concert, which was at the Washington Coliseum in February of 1960.
Right, as opposed to TV performance, this was a full-blown concert.
Yeah, and they end the show by bringing American rock and roll back to these shores, but with their own slant on it. They end with Twist and Shout by the Isley Brothers, and then Little Richard's Long Tall Sally.
The 1-2 punch, but they also opened with Roll Over Beethoven from Chuck Berry from St. Louis, Missouri. So there you go. I mean, they're steeped in this stuff. Worth mentioning, as I said, I did a bit of research to find out where their southern roots were and what acts came from what states. I could only find one that came from Arkansas. And I'd be surprised if anybody in this room knew which act that was, so I'll let you in. Little Willie John, who was from Cullendale, about 4 hours south of here. And the one song they recorded in the studio, they did not release in 1964 when they recorded it for the Beatles For Sale album. And that was?
Leave My Kitten Alone.
Yeah, so let's hear Little Willie's version. See how the Beatles would listen to that and think, that's a great record. However, maybe we'll arrange it more in our style. And that's what they did.
Now tell me, Richard, are you missing the meows?
I must say, they did add something, didn't they?
Yeah.
They really did.
And maybe that's why they shelved that track. Yeah. It was just missing that element.
I'm just amazed that that track wasn't put on Beatles For Sale, actually.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, I know that it's one of those things that typically when you poll Beatle fans what their least favorite Beatle tracks are, there is about three that inevitably end up at the top of the list, one of them being from that same record, Mr. Moonlight, by Dr. Feelgood, also of the South. But and I think it's the organ in that arrangement that tends to be the deal breaker for people. It's them being a little experimental, and to their credit, they're not emulating the record straight up. They're putting, you know, a unique touch on it. And that was a record that they were adding other sort of elements to the recording process. Yeah. You know, the packing case on was it Words of Love, the Buddy Holly song, and the African drum on, was it Mr. Moonlight?
Mr. Moonlight.
Boom, doom, doom, doom. Yeah. So I give them props for wanting to do something a little bit different.
Yeah.
If you hear their Star Club recording from December of 62 of Mr. Moonlight, it's much more of a straight-up rock and roll arrangement, with instead of the solo obviously not being played on organ, it's George Harrison playing it on guitar. And maybe that would have been more acceptable to the masses as not so much of a departure into lounge land by the time they did that.
Thank you.
interesting how, you know, they do some in a country style, some of these numbers. They cover them in a country style.
Yeah.
And then others, they just give it the full rock treatment.
Right. Or they segue into R&B, which is another one of the great elements. And that kind of opens the door to a discussion of Alabama's own Arthur Alexander.
Absolutely.
Another beloved artist. He was an R&B singer from Alabama. He ended his life driving a school bus. The career didn't really pan out for him, although his best known song the Beatles aren't known to have performed, which is You Better Move On.
Right. Yeah, the Rolling Stones covered.
Rolling Stones did it, and a bunch of other people as late as the 1980s were recording that song. But the one they did, they immortalized on their debut album, was Anna, Go to Him.
Yeah.
Let's hear a bit of that.
Well, this is
his
the
version.
Original.
Yes.
That's really very, very close. They recorded it very soon after that was released.
Yeah, it was a 1962 recording by Arthur Alexander, and then the Beatles recorded it in February 1963, so it was still a pretty recent record. And it had been a minor hit for him, but you could see how that song would have its appeal, not only in terms of the soulfulness of the vocal. That's completely in Lennon's wheelhouse.
Yes.
As far as what his great skill was. You know, we did a show a couple shows back on the Beatles' instrumental abilities and standout performances. And in no way to denigrate John as a guitarist or anything else that he played, you know, the others were a lot more superlative in what they brought to the table. But equal of that was John's voice and John's vocals. And someday we'll do a show just on that. But, you know, when his performance of Anna on February 3rd, 1963, a day he had a head cold, and it shows because his voice sounds different than it ever would again. Nonetheless, he really nailed the emotional pull of that track.
He did. I mean, he was a huge Arthur Alexander fan.
Right, and it's
funny, yeah, the tracks that they covered, you know, when they were like on stage, like
yes.
A Lot of Rhythm and Blues.
Right, or Where Have You Been All My Life.
Right, but he never wrote them.
Yeah, Arthur did not write a lot of his own material. He did write Anna, but Where Have You Been All My Life, which we played on our Second Guessing the Beatles show, was actually a Man Weill song, Brill Building Songwriters. And one of the great, great songs that they recorded for the BBC was an Arthur Alexander song called Soldier of Love. And it's another one of those tracks that it's so great that we have their recording of it, because it absolutely could have taken its place alongside any cover that the Beatles actually did issue, and without losing one bit of the quality.
And
it's that good.
You can hear how well it suited to John's vocals.
Yes.
Baby, that's the way.
if you haven't heard that song before, it's just classic Beatle performance that easily could have been in one of the releases.
With blended backing vocals, not just the usual shoe-ups that era.
Yeah, right. And he sings his heart out on it. Yeah. It's a great track. And there was, you can't discount his influence as a songwriter, or at least the songs that Arthur Alexander recorded. Even if he didn't write them, he certainly influenced them as songwriters. Yeah. And Exhibit A, I would point people to, is on the second Beatles album with the Beatles, All I've Got to Do.
Yes.
That's like pure Alexander / Smokey Robinson, perhaps.
Whenever I want you around, yeah. All I gotta do is call you on the phone and you come running home. Yeah, that's all I gotta do. And when I wanna kiss you, yeah. In your ear, the words you long to hear, and I'll be kissing you. And the same goes for me, whenever you want me at all, I'll be here, yes I will, whenever you call. You just gotta call on me, yeah, you just gotta call on me.
You really do hear that sort of Son of Anna. Absolutely. In the verses, yeah. And then they take it in a different direction for the chorus,
yes.
Which is a great example of them blending their influences.
Yeah.
You know, just taking from there and crafting something wholly original.
Yeah, it's just interesting to see how it's not just them covering the music, but actually being influenced, as you said, in the songwriting and creating their own song.
Right. I mean, they could have very easily written their own versions of Long Tall Sally, which eventually they did with I'm Down, but they could have done that earlier on in their career, but they didn't. They were ambitious enough to take the elements and put their own stamp on it,
yeah.
And make it greater than the sum of its parts.
I mean, really, if we look at, you know, the artists who did influence them, mm-hmm. right across the board,
mm-hmm.
most likely the majority were Southern.
They absolutely were.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the most influential songwriters, and another one I want to get to, we mentioned him a little bit before, was Chuck Berry. And granted, a lot of Chuck Berry's hits, they all have a very similar groove to him. You know his sound a mile away. But what made him particularly appealing, especially to Lennon, was his qualities as a lyricist.
Oh,
I mean, he called him rock and roll's first poet.
Yes.
He was that good of just summing up the teenage experience in rhyme, in meter.
Yeah, there were stories in song.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing with the Beatles. They drew from all these different sources. So, you know, Elvis, it was the look and the energy and the sexuality. Buddy Holly, it was the guy next door just attacking the music and the four or five-piece band sort of sound. Little Richard, you know, fantastic vocals.
Right, pulling out all the stops, just rocking it, as they had to do in Hamburg when they were filling up all this, you know, 6 hours a night, 7 days a week stage time. You know, they had to mock show.
In terms of the songwriting, I would say Chuck Berry was the greatest influence of all.
One of the greatest influences of all, yeah. I mean, I would also put Smokey Robinson there, too.
Yeah,
for the soulful ballad sort of stuff.
But Smokey also comes along a little bit later than Chuck.
He does, but he's not of the South, so we'll leave him out of this discussion
exactly.
Right now. Being of Detroit. So is there a particular Chuck Berry song you want to pull as an example?
Well, let's listen first of all to a Chuck Berry recording of a song that the Beatles also popularized.
Rock and roll music, any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it. It's got to be rock and roll music if you want to dance. If you wanna dance with me,
don't get to hear them play a tango. And in the mood they take a mambo. It's way too early for the Congo. So keep a rockin' that piano. That's why I go for that rock and roll music. Any old time you use it, it's got a black beat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it.
And that by the way, was recorded in one take.
Yeah, it's another one. They really amped it up for that performance alongside Chuck Berry's. You can see the difference in the Beatles' approach to it. And it's one that they ultimately, on their final tour, used as their opening song for their sets, although in much shortened form. Because, you know, you listen to the recordings of even the 65 tours, you know, John's voice, when they're playing arenas and they're doing two sets a day, an afternoon and evening performance, I mean, Twist and Shout killed it dead. His voice just falls apart completely. Rock and roll music is no easier a song to sing.
Yeah, if you ever, you know, find the bootleg of the Beatles performing the Sam Houston Coliseum in 65.
Yeah, the Twist and Shout. We played that in one of our shows, right. But also in 66, they're doing rock and roll music. There's a great recording of it done in Japan.
Yeah.
And you could tell that, you know, hit the energy level isn't quite there.
Right.
He's kind of saving himself. But, you know, they set the bar high for sure and what they were trying to get across.
But now here's another song of Chuck Berry's that they did for the BBC sessions. Again, it wasn't, you know, put down in the studio for an album, but it's kind of interesting. You've got these guys from the northwest of England doing a song that's actually set in the South.
Yeah.
Help the information get in touch with my Marie. She's the only one who phoned me here from Memphis, Tennessee. Her home is on the south side, just beyond the ridge, just a half a mile from the Mississippi Bridge. Help the information, Morton, that I cannot add. Only that I miss her and all the fun we had. We were pulled apart because her mom would not agree. Help me get in touch with her in Memphis, Tennessee.
They don't give it the full rock treatment, do they? I mean,
no.
It's just percussion there. There's not.
Yeah, they kind of understate it. And it's a song that they loved so much that they not only did it in their club act in BBC in 63, they also did it at their Decca audition with Pete Best.
Yeah.
So we have several versions of the Beatles performing that song. And, of course, John would eventually meet and perform with Chuck Berry on the set of the Mike Douglas show in 1972.
Yes.
It was a bit of a train wreck.
It was, but, you know, you got to sing Johnny B. Goode with him.
Yeah, he did, in, like, two different keys at the same time. Yeah.
Well, that's, I don't know if anyone's sort of seen Chuck.
Yeah, you know, Chuck. Thankfully, Yoko was there to bang on the drum to really bring up the level of the performance.
Yeah. I saw Chuck Berry, I think...
She thought she was playing. Yeah, yeah. And there was actually no sound coming out.
Right. Oh, you're supposed to plug it in?
Yeah, I saw Chuck Berry. It was his 80th birthday gig in St. Louis a few years back. And, you know, he was, like, playing Wham. People were, like, you know, cheering and bowing at his feet. And he was doing, like, call and response with the guitar.
Uh-huh.
But it had nothing to do with what the song was. You know, it was like, I don't know what he was playing.
Mm.
He just does what he feels like.
I find it very interesting that the one number one hit he had of his entire career
in Britain?
Recorded, well, no, in America.
Oh.
Was recorded live in Britain. My Ding-a-ling.
My Ding-a-ling, absolutely. Yeah.
I guess you Brits have a taste for that sort of thing.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And it was also what's interesting about Chuck Berry is it's so much of his catalog, I think more than any other single artist, that they incorporate into their set. You know, rock and roll music, Roll Over Beethoven, Memphis, I'm Talking About You, Sweet Little 16, Little Queenie, Too Much Monkey Business, Carol, Johnny B. Goode, I've Got to Find My Baby. I mean, that's a ton. That's even more than Buddy, and they did a lot of Buddy. But speaking of Lubbock, Texas... Who else of the rock and roll era comes from there besides Buddy Holly and the Crickets?
You did tell me, and I've forgotten.
Yes, you'd.
I'll give you the spotlight on this one.
Okay. Delbert McClinton.
Right.
He, a great blues harp player, a good guitarist as well. He was first brought to the masses via the 1962 hit by Bruce Chanel, Hey Baby. And that became Bruce's ticket to going on tour in England in 1962. And one of his opening acts for playing the dates in Britain were the Beatles. And it became one of these backstage things where, you know, being, you know, first of all, they're enamored of American recording artists that they get to share a bill with. So they're like, you know, wanting to hang out and, you know, talk with them. But John corners Delbert McClinton, the blues harp player on Hey Baby. How are you getting that note on that record? How do you do that?
Yeah.
And so Delbert takes the time to show this young kid from Liverpool, oh, I'm playing this, and this is how I do it.
And show it to John on the harmonica that he stole.
Yeah, yeah. Right, from Amsterdam on the way to Hamburg the first time. So where does that manifest itself? It then becomes incorporated into the arrangement of Love Me Do, their first single for Parlophone months later.
Please Please Me, From Me to You. You know, I mean, it was like...
It became their signature thing until they said it was becoming too formula, and we dropped it because it was embarrassing.
Yeah.
So that got played out by the middle of 63. Although John would return to the harmonica for All Together Now, 1967.
Right.
And then O Yoko, 1971.
That was the last time.
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now let's go back to like them as songwriters.
Yes.
Going countrified.
I think you have something in mind.
I certainly do. It's 1965.
Oh.
Ringo's first co-songwriting.
I was hoping you wouldn't go there yet.
Oh, well.
Okay. Yes, his co-credit on a song otherwise Lennon-McCartney. I think it was more McCartney than Lennon. And pure straight-up Bakersfield country.
Yeah, in the same year that he'd already recorded Act Naturally.
Yeah, by Buck Owens, who, as distinct from Nashville, was the Bakersfield, California country sound. And he had that hit record in 1963 with Act Naturally. And what prompted the whole recording of the Beatles in 1965 of this two-year-old country hit record was the fact that Ringo needed a song to sing on the album. And the Lennon-McCartney original that they'd given to him, that they took a stab at, wasn't quite coming off, was it?
If You've Got Trouble.
Yeah. Do you happen to have that?
I do, and they had a lot of trouble with this one.
If you can skip to the guitar break, that's like the best part of the song.
You say you're worried, you can't be as worried as me.
John, anybody, help me.
They did one take of that and shelved it.
Yeah. It's one of those songs that sounds like it took longer to perform than it did to write.
So basically, then they get to Rubber Soul.
Well, wait, no. So they record Act Naturally to give Ringo something for that album, and they perform it for a few dates on the 65 tour. I'm sure you people have seen the Beatles at Shea Stadium documentary film concert, and Ringo gets his little spotlight for Act Naturally. There were a lot of technical problems with the production of that in taking the sound off the board and making it worthy of a TV broadcast. That was a record where they straight up dropped in the studio recording. And that's why you hear acoustic guitar on it when they're jamming away at a stadium on electric instruments. They just gave up. It's like, we'll save you, Ringo.
Now, Rubber Soul is a story that their recording engineer, Norman Smith, had written a song that he wanted to get on the album.
Yes. But, can you imagine?
Yeah, really.
Lennon-McCartney, this is the year, 1965. They're hitting that sweet spot as songwriters. You know, Paul Kraft's Yesterday, George is stepping up with I Need You, and by Year's End, If I Needed Someone and Think for Yourself, and John has got Norwegian Wood, In My Life,
Girl,
you know, just
No Way Man,
Help, Ticket to Ride, these amazing songs. Their recording engineer, who's been with them from day one, I've got a song I'd like you guys to try out.
Yeah, and he actually told me, he said that they were on the verge of recording it, and he was so excited, and he came in the next morning, it's like...
Ka-ching.
Yeah, we've actually just written another song, we're sorry, we haven't got space for it.
Right.
But, you know, where they've got to at this point, it's kind of interesting that now they're going to write a song kind of for Ringo, with Ringo, and...
I think his input was limited to a turn of the phrase here or there.
Right, and basically they've got to write for his limited vocal range, so that's number one.
Yes.
But here they're also writing for his musical taste.
His musical taste and his skill set, once again, just as he'd made that country album, or he would make that country album in 1970, with a voice utterly suited for that type of material, here is a foreshadowing in 1965 of the Beatles handing him that platform.
What goes on in your mind?
It's very interesting that there's a straight-up country rock song before country rock really had taken root,
yeah.
Which it would, you know, in 68, the Byrds and some of the other acts, Flying yes. Burrito Brothers.
Yeah, late 60s into the early
70s. Yeah, but here they are. It's an amazingly eclectic collection, the Rubber Soul album is, because, you know, you have your first taste of sitar on a Beatle record.
Yeah.
You've got some, you know, you have You Won't See Me, which is straight pop, but you also got I've Just Seen a Face, which is another sort of country-esque folk-picking song at the time when folk rock...
It was on Help.
It was on Help, but I'm talking to American audiences. You know, Capitol Records has been given credit. Whoa, they crafted an album for American taste to take advantage of folk rock. I think that was more of a hindsight observation.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, because if they wanted to do a folk rock album, they could have put the most bird-sounding recording they ever did on Rubber Soul, which was If I Needed Someone.
Yeah.
And they didn't. They saved that for Yesterday and Today. But, you know, Rubber Soul has got that country-sounding track sung by Ringo on it, and then the album closer is really straight-up rockabilly, the last time they'd really go there, Run for Your Life,
yeah.
Taking direct inspiration from Elvis's...
Baby, Let's Play House.
Yeah, Sun Recording, and using the line, I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, nobody really questioned the sentiments of that at the time. You know, this, you know...
Yeah, really. You know, by the early 70s, Lennon's like, you know, a big women's liver, but...
Right.
At least in 69.
Publicly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You like
that?
We won't get into that. But for those same sessions, what's interesting is, you know, not everything that the Beatles took from the South was country. There was also R&B and soul, particularly Memphis, where you had Stax. And, you know, virtually the house band there was Booker T and the MGs. And they'd had that great hit in 1962 that was a worldwide hit, Green Onions, that instrumental. We have that, don't we?
We certainly do.
Now, from this distance, it's not recalled by many people, unless you really think about it, but the 1960s was a time when instrumental records were often big hits. You know, you don't hear people crafting instrumental hits these days too much. It's been much more of a speaker's medium.
Well, it was a much broader range in the charts generally.
Oh, definitely.
In the UK as well as in the US. You know, you still had the kind of Perry Como, Frank Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra, you know, Tony Bennett,
yeah.
Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, and you'd have
that
jazz.
Were,
you know, we had trad jazz in the UK
mm-hmm.
there in the early 60s.
Right.
And as you say, instrumentals.
Yeah, a lot. You know, the Bill Black combo that was mentioned yesterday in the Kit and Caboodle show, and we mentioned it in our last show, they were an act that opened for the Beatles in their 64 tour, Bill Black being Elvis's bass player, although Bill Black himself was not on that tour because he was dying of brain cancer at the time.
Yeah.
But they were an act that had hit records of instrumental hits by other people.
Yeah.
So... Come 1965, and again, the Beatles are working on the Rubber Soul album, this eclectic collection. They decide to take their own stab at sort of a Green Onions, Stax, Memphis type of instrumental. It did not see the light of day until Anthology in the 90s. And the title that it was given, which to me sounds like a working title,
yeah.
That because they never issued it, they never came up with a proper title,
yeah.
12-bar original.
Thank you.
could see they're kind of going for that kind of Stax groove there, but not quite pulling it off. And I think they must have realized that because they didn't put it out at the time. But it's interesting their approach to it, because you've got a little bit of organ on there.
Yeah.
Just as Booker T and the MGs did, a different sounding organs, a different voice, but and George playing, you know, if not quite his own version of Steve Cropper, at least right. He's trying to emulate that sort of
absolutely.
Approach.
And in fact, you know, the album Rubber Soul, right, you know, we know that that was also, because there was a soul boom in Britain at that time.
Sure, it was sort of a play on that genre.
Yeah.
But such was the Beatles' interest in what was coming out of the Stax Studios in Memphis. This is something I talk about in my Revolver book, The Making of Revolver. In fact, let me do this right. My Revolver book.
There you go.
they came really close to recording at Stax Studios. And that would have had, you know, Steve Cropper was basically the house producer there.
Yeah.
And Brian actually flew out, Brian Epstein, their manager, to book studio time and find a house for the Beatles to stay in.
Yep.
And the whole deal fell apart when, number one, Stax made the bad business decision to jack up their studio rates for the Beatles, thinking they could afford it, and they were going to milk the cash cow.
That was a really sharp move.
Yeah, and then the other thing was that the word got out that the Beatles were coming to town. Now, Memphis being a big music community, as is Nashville, every song plugger in town besieged Stax with, we've got songs that'd be great for the Beatles to record. You know, like, yeah, really? Better than Lennon McCartney? And it fell through. And they actually did consider recording at Motown.
Yes.
And Memphis at another facility in Atlantic in New York, but it didn't happen. And Steve Cropper would later lament, it's too bad that we couldn't make that happen. Taxman could have been Staxman.
There you go. Yeah.
Yes. So it didn't happen, and what ended up happening in its place when the Beatles recorded Revolver was they did step up things. Jeff Emmerich became their engineer.
Yeah.
They got a lot more experimental. So their main complaint about recording at EMI was the fact that they were listening to the records coming out of Memphis and hearing this big, fat bass sound, and they thought, these American studios are way better than Parlophone. You know, how come we can't get these kind of sounds? And Emmerich helped them get them for the Paperback Writer Rain single.
Also the mastering of the records. I know
yeah.
a lot of British engineers, recording engineers in the early 60s would actually, you know, study American records to hear that hot sound that they've got
right.
with the bass especially.
And EMI was particularly cautious with their technology. They would acquire, you know, they'll go from a two-track recording to a four-track recording and keep that going for as long as possible. But then when they acquired an eight-track state-of-the-art recording device in late 67, early 68, whenever it was.
Early 68.
Yeah, and it's at the same time when this is the norm in America, they brought it in and they sort of kept it in the closet because they said, well, our engineers have to test it out first. We have to, you know, run it, put it through its paces before we even let anybody record this. We got to make sure what's what about this.
They've got the most cutting edge band in the world.
Yes.
And here they're being cautious.
Yeah. So what happened during the White Album sessions was the Beatles, quote-unquote, liberated it. They took it out of storage and started using it. In the meantime, they'd been using the 8-track facilities at Trident to record Hey Jude and some other White Album tracks.
Yeah, the first track that they did on the 8-track was While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yes, and so after that, they were off and running. But we're going to wind down the show now in this discussion of the Beatles' southern roots with a straight-up country number, of course, from Ringo, recorded during the White Album sessions. Complete with country style fiddler on it.
Yeah.
Don't Pass Me By.
Yeah, and I have to say that, you know, if you want to hear the Beatles' musical influences as well as who they influenced, the White Album, it's all there. You know, you've got everything from music hall to country to blues to
folk,
rock,
yeah, R&B.
Absolutely.
Avant-garde, experimental.
Yeah, music,
yeah.
Concrete, yeah.
Yeah, it's everything. But they recorded that, and the story with Don't Pass Me By is, you know, it was Ringo's first solely credited composition. You know, woohoo, you know, he's finally writing songs. And this was after years of, you know, telling interviewers, oh, I bring in my material, but then they fall down on the floor laughing when they say that you've just rewritten that Jerry Lee Lewis B-side, you know. And if it's
do you know when he first mentioned that song?
Yes.
Yeah.
When did he first mention that song?
1963.
On Saturday, was it the Brian Matthews Show? Saturday Club.
Club. Yeah.
He mentions when Brian Matthews, the BBC interviewer, is talking to them, well, Ringo, you know, what have you been working on? And, well, I've got the song Don't Pass Me By.
Ringo, how about your songwriting? How's that coming on?
Oh, yes, I've written a good one, you see, but
yes?
No one seems to want to record
now,
it.
Now,
Oh, Paul made me call on and
no.
Yes, Paul, you promised.
Okay. No, the thing Paul. Is, I was doing the tune for you to sing it.
No, I don't want to sing. You sing
don't
that.
Pass me by. Oh, you do.
Rhythm and blues song.
Oh, yeah. Don't pass me by. Don't make me cry. Don't make me blue, baby. Because you know why?
I got the ice cream for you.
Yeah, well, it's a sensation.
You wrote all those words?
Yeah, blues and all that.
He's a Dylan Thomas of Liverpool, isn't he?
So you had to wait 5 years to get it recorded.
Richard, art cannot be rushed.
Absolutely. Including art, where it's got the great line, I'm sorry that I doubted you, I was so unfair.
You were in a car crash and you lost your hair. So, which, of course, became a Paul is Dead clue the following year. Oh, look, car crash. Paul, that's who he's singing about.
Yeah, really.
Right.
Anyway, my name is Richard Buskin.
I'm Robert Rodriguez.
And this has been
Something About the Beatles.
I listen for your footsteps coming up the drive. Listen for your footsteps, but they don't arrive. Waiting for your knock, dear, on my old front door. I don't hear it. Does it mean you don't love me anymore? I hear the clock a-ticking on the mantel shelf. See the hands a-moving, but I'm by myself. I wonder where you are tonight, and why I'm by myself. I don't see you. Does it mean you don't love me anymore? Don't pass me by, don't make me cry, don't make me blue. 'Cause you know, darling, was so unfair. You were in a car crash and you lost your hair. You said that you would be late about an hour or two. I said, that's all right, I'm waiting here, just waiting to hear from you. Don't pass me by, don't make me cry, don't make me blue. 'Cause you know, darling,
Something About the Beatles, recorded at Strad Studios, produced by Thomas Rapetney. Executive producer, Rick Way.
regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy.